leapfrog forward to, again, now it's 10 days into the current Bush administration. And Dick Cheney has a meeting called the Cheney Energy Task Force. And we only know about the Cheney Energy Task Force because there was the Supreme Court ruling that forced only some of the findings to be made public. But we do know who was there. Bechtel was there. Halliburton was there. Chevron was there. Exxon was there. And they were these guys were designing our new national energy policy. So part of that new national energy policy was a chart, and under the heading of "We need to gain greater access to Middle East oil," was a chart that laid out all of the foreign companies that had contracts for Iraq's oil. So if you'll recall, this is the sanctions period when the United States had sanctions against Iraq, when the whole world had sanctions against Iraq, most of it because of the United Nations. And Saddam Hussein was signing oil contracts with lots of companies from all around the world, but none of them could come into force while the sanctions were in place. The reason for signing the contracts, however, was because global public opinion was aggressively against the sanctions. The more that people learned about the brutal impact of the sanctions, the more likely it was that the sanctions were going to be eliminated. If the sanctions were eliminated, all of those other foreign companies were going to get access to all that oil, and the United States was going to be cut out. So we invaded, and it is an absolute fallacy that there was no post-invasion plan for Iraq. There was a very clear plan. It was an economic plan. It was written by a company called Bearing Point, Inc. They're based in Virginia. They had a $250 million contract to rebuild Iraq's economy. That plan was then put into place to a T by L. Paul Bremer, earning the name the new dictator of Iraq after about a month on the ground. He was the head of the U.S. the U.S. occupation government of Iraq, the Coalition Provisional Authority. In that position, one of the things he did was name a man named Bara Alum to become one of the first oil ministers of Iraq. Back to before the war. Before the war, a State Department group meets. It says, what should Iraq's oil infrastructure look like after the war? Let's think of something that would work for us really well. What the State Department comes up with is a plan that says that Iraq's oil should be, surprise, surprise, open to private, foreign, corporate investment on terms that are highly favorable to the private, foreign companies. And more importantly, we really need to get rid of those pesky pre-existing contracts. So the first thing that Bara Alum does is cancel all those pesky pre-existing contracts. So the slate is cleared. And Paul Bremer implements a new economic agenda for Iraq. These policies, if you go back to the start of my talk, are just free trade, but, you know, with a neocon twist. A flat tax in Iraq, because they couldn't get one here, which would brought down the corporate income tax in Iraq from 40% to 15%, and brought up all taxes for all people who didn't have to pay taxes. They now had to pay 15% of their income. Things like making it impossible through a provision called national treatment for the Iraqis to give preference to Iraqi companies or workers in the reconstruction. So instead, 150 U.S. companies have received $50 billion for work in Iraq. The largest contracts have gone to Bechtel. Remember Bechtel back in our story? George Shultz now back on the board of directors of Bechtel. Bechtel gets $2.8 billion for reconstruction in Iraq. Parsons, Fluor, Shaw, these names should all sound familiar to anyone who is paying attention to reconstruction in New Orleans. Exact same companies. Exact same failure. A brand new report by the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction just came out, which cites tremendous, tremendous, tremendous failure on the part of U.S. companies. And I'm going to touch on this really quickly. So Bechtel gets $2.8 billion to rebuild water, electricity, sewage systems. Parsons, Shaw, they all get huge contracts. We only hear about Halliburton's contract, which we should, because at this point it's up to about $20 billion. But what the contract that is actually the most important to the people in Iraq and probably the most damaging to U.S. soldiers who have been and were operating in Iraq were the reconstruction contracts. Because this was billions and billions of dollars that went to U.S. companies. Without competition, they were cost plus, which meant that they were guaranteed their cost plus a fixed rate of return. They didn't do most of the reconstruction. According to the new report, only half of the projects in water, electricity, and sewage are complete. A full third in electricity didn't even begin. 3.5 years later, right? We paid out $15 billion. And the Iraqis, let me back up again, two Bremer orders. One Bremer order fired 120,000 of all the ranking bureaucrats in the Iraqi ministries. These were the people who ran the water systems, the electricity systems, the healthcare systems, the education systems. They were fired because they would stand in the way of the reconstruction that the U.S. government had in mind. And, of course, the 500,000 Iraqi soldiers famously let go by Paul Bremer. What this meant was a tremendous increase in unemployment, but also people who the U.S. military had thought would do the reconstruction. That was part of the original idea of some of the smarter people, particularly soldiers in the military who were first charged with reconstruction, was that the soldiers, the former Iraqi soldiers, instead of taking their guns home to join the insurgency, would be given, you know, shovels and clipboards and would go to work doing the reconstruction. No. We've got American companies to do that. So the American companies came in and failed miserably. 3.5 years, electricity, water, sewage, still not at pre-war levels. In Baghdad, there's only 8 hours of electricity a day. There used to be 24 hours of electricity a day in Baghdad. Now, the people in Iraq were very unhappy about this. They needed the jobs. They needed to rebuild their country. They did it in 3 months after the last U.S. invasion of Iraq, and instead there were U.S. companies running around doing the work. This created, obviously, a tremendous amount of hostility and definitely has fed the violent resistance and the insurgency in Iraq. While the economic infrastructure was rebuilt, an oil law was slow, the one developed by the State Department, was slowly making its way through the Iraqi government. Now, the oil companies are smarter than the Bush administration. They knew, okay, the Bremer orders are illegal. They're illegal under international law. They're illegal under the Geneva Conventions, and I can explain that more later because I'm going to wrap up in 2 minutes. The oil companies knew that if the Bush administration went in and privatized the oil, that might be difficult. And so what they wanted was for an elected Iraqi government to pass a law which transformed the oil infrastructure so that they could sign legal contracts with a legal government and everything would be kosher. So this oil law has been shepherded through the Iraqi government through several Bremer appointees. Abdel Mahdi, who's the current vice president, the former prime minister, Ayed Alawi, shepherded this law through. It's now about 2 months from passage, according to the new oil minister of Iraq. The U.S. government and U.S. oil companies are heavily involved in ensuring that that happens. Once the oil law is passed, U.S. oil companies can sign contracts. But they're going to need security to get to work. What's the best security force in the world? 130,000 American troops. So I argue that the troops, unless we have quite a bit to say about it, are planned to stay there until this economic agenda is fulfilled. Now, real quickly, the rest of the agenda. 1 month after the invasion, the Bush administration announced plans for a U.S. Middle East free trade area, which would expand the economic agenda across the Middle East. With the threat of the Iraq war looming over the governments of the Middle East, these agreements are moving ahead at lightning speed. And this will open up the rest of the region, and already is, to foreign corporate advancement, with the ever-present threat of some sort of U.S. military action always present. Now, a couple things. The positive side of all of this is that for 3.5 years, while the U.S. corporate agenda has moved forward in Iraq, so has the anti-U.S. corporate agenda lobbied and worked very, very aggressively against this process. Yay. So I know I personally have protested in front of more corporations and been arrested in front of more corporations in the last 3 years than I can. Well, not that I can count, it's four times, but that I've been arrested. That this is a very alive force, and it has had an impact. So Bechtel Corporation, which has been protested against time and time again, did not seek new contracts in Iraq because it couldn't handle any more of the public pressure on it. Halliburton recently lost its huge cash cow, the log cap contract. That is through public pressure. That is a $20 billion contract. Do you think that Cheney wanted to cut a $20 billion contract from Halliburton? Hell no. Halliburton had to pay, and the way that it is paid through public pressure and congressional pressure is that that huge contract was canceled. In addition, the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction is now, finally, after 3.5 years, looking at each of these individual contracts in Iraq and looking at the failure of individual companies. And because of that, they just canceled a $50 million contract that Bechtel had to build a hospital in Basra that it's held for 3.5 years that it just hasn't built, just hasn't done it. So the answer on the contracts is, one, to keep up the pressure, two, to demand that all of the U.S. contracts are canceled, that the money is returned, and most importantly, that all of the money goes to Iraqi companies. There are hundreds and hundreds of public and private companies that are more than capable of doing this work, that are ready to do the work, that have done the work before, that if they held the contracts themselves, would be able to do the work and, as experience has shown in Iraq, do it far more cheaply than U.S. companies are able to do it. And that also experience has shown that insurgents do not attack the work of contracts held by Iraqi companies when they're at work, and that the target is at contracts that are held by U.S. companies, even if it's Iraqi workers. Okay, that aside. Also, you know, as I said in the beginning, most importantly, I have met with many, many U.S. veterans from Iraq who have said that it's through reading and through learning, in addition to their experiences in Iraq, but learning about the corporate interests, learning about this larger agenda that has helped edify them on the need and on the words to say to explain why they don't want to fight, why other people shouldn't fight, and that the information needs to be spread to exist. If soldiers aren't there to fight, then obviously there won't be a war. And if the corporations can't make a profit off of the war, there won't be a war. And if we continue to hold the companies to account, our elected officials to account, there are good ones. Remember John Conyers, who I spoke about? He's in there. There are good ones in there, and they're pushing, and they are making a difference, but obviously we can't just count on them. So we can talk more about solutions, organizing that we can do, organizing that everyone can do, and I really look forward to your questions and the discussion. I have a website. It's thebushagenda.net, and thank you all very, very, very much for coming out.
So now is your chance. We have our Q&A session, and anyone, I know that everyone has opinions on the military-industrial complex.
Thanks for the questions, and on the next slew of questions, I am going to encourage some women to please stand up and ask some questions. I know you have them. Just come up and ask. Okay. The Project for the New American Century, I failed to mention, by the way, that I have books here, and I'm going to sign them, and I came up, you made me think of it, because I have a very large focus in the book on the Project for the New American Century. Okay, raise your hand if you know about the Project for the New American Century. Please do. Okay, I don't have to explain it. One of the things I do have to say, though, is that I think it's important for us when we talk about the Project for the New American Century to repeat that there are 16, the same number as Lockheed Martin employees, 16 current members of the Bush administration that participated in the Project for the New American Century. So we don't just talk about it because, you know, it's a left-wing conspiracy. We talk about it because it's a full 16 members. It's Cheney, it's Rumsfeld, it's Wolfowitz, it's Zelig, it's Libby, it's Khalilzad. It's all of the guys who are making all of the decisions on this war and in this administration, and they laid out their interests very clearly in the writing of the Project for the New American Century, and therefore we should constantly be reminding the American public of what are in those documents. Those documents do, in fact, talk about economic issues, and what I try and do in the book is pull out of all of the sort of key documents that we talk about that are important documents, the National Security Strategy of 2002, the defense planning guidance of 1992, sort of key documents, the economic aspects of the agenda. And basically what comes out very clearly is the desire, and they say it, is the desire to team, you know, the most expensive and most aggressive and most advanced military with the advancement of these economic interests, and that is the most clearly on display in Iraq, but certainly not the only place where this agenda can and will play out. So the question on Iran and the sort of larger strategic look into Iran, I'm not going to address all of that here. You know, there's a very, very, very long strategic history of the U.S. in Iran, of the U.S. trying to get back into Iran. I think there are a lot of these guys that really think that Iran, you know, is really the rightful property of the United States, and it, you know, sort of passed off in that little revolution, but that, you know, it really belongs back to us, and for no other reason than there's a heck of a lot of oil down there. And that I do believe it's quite clear that the administration is really intent on going to Iran, but the fact that it hasn't in an overt way yet is because of our activity. And I want to emphasize, you know, Todd standing every weekend holding the banner, we can never, ever, ever underestimate the impact of those actions, of every weekend action, of every conversation that we have, of every protest that never makes it into the news. I don't know, you know, you probably don't know that we shut down Bechtel's headquarters on Wednesday, but in San Francisco we did that. It's good, it was great. It didn't make any news coverage, but that's not the point. The people in Bechtel certainly knew about it, and we knew about it, and we then tell the story here, and then you then tell the story elsewhere, and we get it printed, and Dar writes about it, and then it gets on indie media, and that this is how, you know, the revolution will be spread here. And we have to write the headlines of our victories, because they won't. And it is a victory right now that the Bush administration hasn't gone into Iran. And, you know, we have to hold them to that. But we can't forget about Iraq. This is one of the things that I have found difficult in the last several weeks, which, of course, the horrendous activities of Israel in Lebanon and Gaza right now have to have a tremendous amount of our attention, but we can't not look at what's going on in Iraq at the same time, because they're slipping through a lot of these laws that I'm talking about right now, and it just happens to be at this moment when the world's attention is not looking at Iraq. The permanent bases, the permanent military bases are down to 4 right now, and the way that they're being advanced in Iraq is basically through a definitional game. So what does it mean to have a permanent military base? Well, I'm laying concrete on this base, but I'm just laying concrete because that will make it safer for U.S. soldiers in the facility right now. It's not to make it permanent. We'll take it up later. So the way they're sort of getting at building the bases is by a definitional exercise, and it is our responsibility to hold them accountable that the permanent military bases don't get built. I forgot something. Oh, the mercenaries. Do you mean to the extent of John Perkins' analysis of economic hitmen? Is that what you mean? We are not ever going to, in our lifetimes certainly, going to do away with those who have interests in making a profit off of wars, off of economic invasions, off of you know, the suffering of others. And so there will be mercenaries and economic mercenaries. But what we can do is remove the institutions that support their activities, and we are doing that. So the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have been deflated. It's like someone took a pin into them. It's not that they're not acting, but their ability to move forward their agenda has been dramatically. Same with the World Trade Organization. How did that happen? Well, part of it happened here, and it is through the pressure of social movements that the WTO, that the voices in the WTO that were contrary to the United States and the European Union and the Quad that they're called, have essentially made it function as a somewhat democratic institution, and therefore it doesn't work anymore. And Carlyle. Okay, real quick, because I want Todd to speak and I want other people to speak as well. Carlyle Group. I did not focus on the Carlyle Group. I think the Carlyle Group is very important. But I think that in this particular war that we're in right now, the upfront economic beneficiaries are a low-hanging fruit that we can get, and so we should. And we can expose these companies, and we can immediately reduce their ability to profit off of the war, and therefore we should. That doesn't mean that the other companies and infrastructure aren't important. It just means that I think we have to be focused and we have to have our victories. And I think that we can also, you know, stop this war through a lot of this focus. Fascism, oh dear. Fascism, okay. Antonia, it's like a mind teaser game. Are they fascist? Yes, they're fascist. Of course they're fascist. Of course it's fascism. But to me, it's why I also don't say that is such a self-defeating word to me. You know, it's like this, it's like you make this label and you give them this power over you. You know, to me it's really disempowering. And yes, but so what?
Right. I'd like to take a couple of whacks at this also. First, I wanted to respond to Marvin's comments about Alliant Tech Systems in Minneapolis and the actions that they're doing. And to me, this is hot. This is the way to do it. And incidentally, this campaign of stopping the merchants of death. Simon Herrick has been through here. Has anybody ever seen his PowerPoint? I mean, there are people who do the definitive PowerPoint on the military-industrial complex. He's one of them. You can go out into Google and do this sometime. Military-industrial congressional complex, in quotes, file type, PPT. And what you'll get is all the PowerPoints, and there's about 500 PowerPoints that people have done on the military-industrial complex. It is just a great way to do your research. And so Simon's, I was going to play his, you know, we haven't got that kind of time. But I'd certainly agree that it is fascism, and that was the original meaning of the word fascism. But when, as soon as you start using the word, the media has been there before us, you know. And there are three really cultural institutions. Let's not forget the educational system, which has been taken to some degree, and the pulpit. So without these three great reservoirs of knowledge and culture, human beings are nothing. I mean, we're helpless, you know. I mean, we'd just be as helpless as a turtle without a shell, because we are a mental and cooperating species. The repositories of our knowledge and our what we are as human beings are in these institutions. Everything that we do here today is lost in the background noise, because there's this great roar of 7 billion people going forward, and it's being guided by the institutions, you know. And just one more comment there was here. How do we stop the MIC from growing and taking over elections? There are at least 25 different ways that our elections and our democracy are really under attack. Everything from the gerrymandering trick in Texas, the corruption in elections, which predates voting machines. And there's a great campaign right now is to get the voting machines fixed. And then the other one is publicly financed campaigns. Thanks for your patience.
It's a wonderful strew of questions. Also, on my website, thebushagenda.net, you can email me, and I'm very happy to respond to emails and questions. Okay, I'm going to unfortunately sort of have to pick and choose, but some of these go together, and it's the sort of what we can do questions that has to do with the Democrats, that has to do with buying shares, boycotts. Here's what I think. In terms of successful campaigning against the companies, you can act as a consumer, you can act as a stockholder, and you can act as a citizen of the United States who is represented by government officials. So there are several things we can do. I think one of the most important ways to undermine the power of the oil and gas corporations is to advocate as aggressively as possible for increased public spending on public transit so that people don't have to drive as much. It's one of the crucial missing links, particularly for folks in the middle class who say, oh, I just don't, you know, I just won't drive as much. people who are incredibly dependent on their cars for transportation really need public transit as an alternative option, and that's a government decision. We can implement a windfall profits tax on oil companies right now, and that money can be redirected immediately to public transit and to alternative fuels. Of course, we have to advocate alternative fuels, use alternative fuels, consume less. I think boycotts are fine as long as it's very, very clear that you are providing really good information on why you're boycotting. And most importantly, is the boycott supported by the people who you're boycotting on behalf of? So let's say if we're boycotting on behalf of ending the Iraq war, you know, the Iraqi oil workers aren't calling for a boycott of Iraqi oil yet. They might if this law passes. They still need the sales of their oil. And so I think boycotting the oil companies becomes tricky. However, we also have very explicit interests, domestic interests, in protesting and boycotting the oil companies. So I leave that to you to debate among yourselves and in your own groups. I firmly advocate, I don't drive, I don't have a car. You know, if you can do that, the best thing that you can do is not to use their product to your greatest extent possible, and do the things you need to do to make that possible. That means public transit, that means alternative fuels, that means fuel-efficient cars, working to increase fuel efficiency standards, working to increase the regulations on the oil and gas companies, to break up their monopolies in particular is another amazing thing that we can do, which will have a huge influence on the American democracy if there aren't companies that are ExxonMobil, Chevron, Texaco, ConocoPhillips, right? These mergers have made these mega companies that have these mega profits, that have mega influence over our elected officials. Buy stock, yeah, totally. Stockholder action is very, very important. It's very influential. It's increasingly influential. And I encourage people to also participate on that level if you can. The Democrats, the Lamont victory is critically important for us to understand that we can, in fact, win, and win in a state like Ohio, which does have incredible issues of voter fraud and voter manipulation and control by the Republicans, but Lamont still won. And I think we can work on all of these fronts at the same time, or we can pick and choose. I think we can work for candidates that represent the issues that we want. We can campaign against the corporations. We can support soldiers that don't want to fight in the war. We can work as consumers, or we can do one of those things that feels right. I think we all also get stuck in this place, which is there's so much wrong. And we know, we're some of the lucky ones that know of all the great work that's going on, that we then get stymied and we say, wow, I really should be working here. I really should be working here. Have faith in the rest of the movement. You know, you're not alone. There are people working here and here and here. And where you are most effective is on the thing that really feels right to you, that you can communicate to your community, that you can work on every day and feel good about and feel proud about. And every once in a while, you're going to do other stuff in there too. But that makes us the most effective activists, I think. And so I'm just going to say really quickly, Israel. I believe that the United States is fighting a proxy war through Israel right now. I believe that it is very much, you know, my colleague Phyllis Bennis at the Institute for Policy Studies is the goddess of everything Middle East. She is an expert, she is an activist, she is brilliant, she writes better than anyone on the planet, and she just puts out information every week about the conflict that you have to read. It's at the Institute for Policy Studies. But and she wrote very clearly in a recent piece about, you know, and it dovetails with my analysis in my book, which is the Bush administration has very clear hegemonic interests in the Middle East. They are about denying power to China and Russia as well. So if the United States has the oil, China doesn't. And the United States gets to decide when China gets it and under what terms, right? That's another way of containing geopolitical power. Shout it out.
I think China's going to pull the economic plug on us and we won't have any oil.
It's possible. Our economic interests are dovetailing more and more and more, though their economic interests are dovetailing more and more. Oil is not just about oil company profits. Oil is about geopolitical control. And the Bush administration and U.S. governments for a very long time have felt this need and have said that they would use the U.S. Military to advance our interest to the U.S. interest to protect their government's interest to protect access to the region's oil. What is unique about this administration in modern American history is the desire not just to prop up dictators that would support U.S. access, but go in, rewrite the laws, lock in the economic interests of U.S. corporations to gain as much access as possible. And this is where the oil law comes in. The oil law, as I said in the beginning of the presentation, in Iraq is set to be passed in approximately 2 months' time. What we can demand is, one, that the U.S. government should not have any say whatsoever over the new oil infrastructure of Iraq. If we do, that makes it a little bit painfully clear as to why we went in the first place, right? That we can cancel contracts, for example, for companies like Bearing Point. One of the things that Bearing Point is still doing on the ground in Iraq is advising on the new oil law. That contract should be canceled and Bearing Point should be brought home. We can demand the end of the military occupation of Iraq will tremendously alter this economic equation. So when we fight and when we demand that the troops be brought home, we are also demanding an end to the economic invasion as well. And that will go a long way towards ending the ability of the new oil law to have its control over Iraq and could, in fact, open the door for the Iraqis to actually be making these decisions over their own oil, which is what the oil companies are demanding, oil workers are demanding in Iraq. I'm just going to end to say, please visit my website, thebushagenda.net, because I have links to a number of great organizations that are working on these issues that will be useful for you to have and useful for you to increase the dialogue. And I'm going to let Todd close us out, and thank you all for coming in, and I'm going to sign books.
Well, thank you very much, and that pretty well closes it out. I just want to make one more comment. It wouldn't be fair to myself if I didn't tell you my opinion about the boycott idea, and because 3 years ago, or 4 years ago now, when this thing came over the horizon, I thought it'd be a great idea if there was a general strike, and I looked at all my neighbors, and they weren't going on strike, and so I went on strike, and I quit working. I don't work anymore. I don't care about money, and I don't give a damn what anybody thinks. I'm not working at all, and I'm mad about it, and I'm not a happy camper. I haven't worked a day for a dollar since 2002, and I don't plan to work another day the rest of my life. I spent all my life savings. I burned my CPA license. It's all a bunch of corrupt, rotten crap, and you know it. There's a lot of you out there who feels the same way I feel. And people, guess what? I ran out of money, and guess what? People are feeding me. People give me money to buy food. I got rid of my car. I ride my bike everywhere. You know how much you need to live on? It's peanuts. You need one bowl of chili from Wendy's every day. That's a dollar. I count it up. You know how much is it? It's not hard to live in this country. Go on strike. Get everybody else to go on strike. Withhold your cooperation. Don't give your labor. Don't give your money. Take it all back. Take your money and convert it to yen and invest it, convert it to euros. Just totally go on strike. Boycott American products, okay? Don't boycott foreign products. This is where it's at. Just totally go on strike. Get as many people as you can to go on strike, okay? That's how you go on strike. You don't ask other people to go on strike.
You just heard a workshop, Structural Costs of War, the Oil Industry, the Arms Industry, and the New Military-Industrial Complex, with Antonio Juhasz and Todd Boyle. Recorded at the 2006 Veterans for Peace National Convention. Thanks to Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio for both these tapes. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA, Olympia, WRFN, Nashville, KRBS, Oroville, The Surge, 96.3, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. I'll finish the program reading the next installment of John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education, his exposé on the creation and goals of compulsory schooling. John Taylor Gatto was New York State Teacher of the Year in 1991 when he suddenly announced his decision to leave teaching. His 30-year career in the Manhattan schools, which he wrote about in the last chapter, had brought him to the realization that schools were not making people smarter, but rather the opposite. He began a decade of research that led to the publication of this book, The Underground History of American Education. This week we begin part two of the book, The Foundations of Schooling, starting with the chapter, True Believers and the Unspeakable Chautauqua. From start to finish, school as we know it is a tale of true believers and how they took the children to a land far away. All of us have a tiny element of true believer in our makeups. You have only to reflect on some of your own wild inner urges and the lunatic gleam that comes into your eyes on those occasions to begin to understand what might happen if those impulses were made a permanent condition. Gatto provides this quote by Joanne Brown. A very small group of young psychologists around the turn of the century were able to create and market a system for measuring human talent that has permeated American institutions of learning and influenced such fundamental social concepts as democracy, sanity, justice, welfare, reproductive rights, and economic progress. In creating, owning, and advertising this social technology, the testers created themselves as professionals. From The Definition of a Profession, The Authority of Metaphor in the History of Intelligence Testing by Joanne Brown. And this from Charles H. Thurber. I have undertaken to get at the facts from the point of view of the businessmen, citizens of the community who, after all, pay the bills, and therefore have a right to say what they shall have in their schools. From an address at the annual meeting of the National Education Association, July 9, 1897, Charles H. Thurber. The self-interested have had a large hand in conceiving and executing 20th century schooling. Yet, once that said, self-interest isn't enough to explain the zeal in confining other people's children in rooms, locked away from the world, the infernal zeal which, like a toadstool, keeps forcing its way to the surface in this business. Among millions of normal human beings professionally associated with the school adventure, a small band of true believers has been loose from the beginning. Brothers and sisters whose eyes gleam in the dark, whose heartbeat quickens at the prospect of acting as change agents for a purpose beyond self-interest. For true believers, children are test animals. The strongest belt in the engine of schooling is the strand of true belief. True believers can be located by their rhetoric. It reveals a scale of philosophical imagination which involves plans for you and me. All you need to know about Mr. Laszlo, whose timeless faith song is cited in the front of this book, is that the we he joins himself to, the masters who manipulate, doesn't really include the rest of us except as objects of the exercise. Here is a true believer in full gallop. School history is crammed with wild-eyed orators lurking just behind the lit stage, like Hugo Munsterberg. Munsterberg was one of the people who was in on the birth of 20th century mass schooling. In 1892, a recent emigre to America from Wilhelm Wundt's Laboratory of Physiological Psychology at Leipzig in Saxony, he was a Harvard professor of psychology. Munsterberg taught his students to look at schools as social laboratories suitable for testing theory, not as aggregates of young people pursuing their own purposes. The St. Louis Exposition of 1904 showcased his ideas for academicians all over the world, and the popular press made his notions familiar to upper middle classes horrified by the unfamiliar family ways of immigrants, eager to find ways to separate immigrant children from those alien practices of their parents. Munsterberg's particular obsession lay in quantifying the mental and physical powers of the population for central government files, so policymakers could manage the nation's human resources efficiently. His students became leaders of the standardization crusade in America. Munsterberg was convinced that racial differences could be reduced to numbers, equally convinced it was his sacred duty to the Aryan race to do so. Aryanism crackled like static electricity across the surface of American university life in those days, its implications part of every corporate board game and government bureau initiative. One of Munsterberg's favorite disciples, Lillian Wald, became a powerful advocate of medical incursions into public schools. The famous progressive social reformer wrote in 1905, "It's difficult to place a limit upon the service which medical inspection should perform. Is it not logical to conclude that physical development should so far as possible be demanded?" 1 year later, immigrant public schools in Manhattan began performing tonsillectomies and adenoidectomies in school without notifying parents. The New York Times of June 29, 1906, reported that, quote, "frantic Italians, many armed with stilettos, stormed three schools, attacking teachers and dragging children from the clutches of the true believers into whose hands they had fallen." Think of the conscience which would ascribe to itself the right to operate on children at official discretion, and you will know beyond a doubt what a true believer smells like. Even a cursory study of the history of the school institution turns up true belief in rich abundance. In a famous book, The Proper Study of Mankind, paid for by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and the Russell Sage Foundation, the favorite principle of true believers since Plato makes an appearance, quote, "A society could be completely made over in something like 15 years. The time it takes to inculcate a new culture into a rising group of youngsters," close quote. Despite the spirit of profound violence hovering over such seemingly bloodless abstract formulas, this is indeed the will-o'-the-wisp pursued throughout the 20th century in forced schooling. Not intellectual development, not character development, but the inculcation of a new synthetic culture in children, one designed to condition its subjects to a continual adjusting of their lives by unseen authorities. It is true that numerically, only a small fraction of those who direct institutional schooling are actively aware of its ideological bent. But we need to see that without consistent generalship from the knowledgeable group in guiding things, the evolution of schooling would long ago have lost its coherence, degenerating into battles between swarms of economic and political interests, fighting over the treasure house that hermetic pedagogy represents. One of the hardest things to understand is that true believers, dedicated ideologues, are useful to all interests in the school stew by providing a salutary continuity to the enterprise. Because of the predictable greed embedded in this culture, some overarching guardian vision, one indifferent to material gain, seems necessary to prevent marketplace chaos. True believers referee the school game, establishing its goals, rules, penalties. They negotiate and compromise with other stakeholders. And strangely enough, above all else, they can be trusted to continue being their predictable, dedicated, selfless selves. Pragmatic stakeholders need them to keep the game alive. True believers need pragmatists as cover. Consider this impossibly melodramatic if you must. I know myself that parts of my story sound like leaves torn from ragtime. But from start to finish, this is a tale of true believers and how by playing on their pipes, they took all the children away. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. One dependable signal of a true believer's presence is a strong passion for everyone's children. Find nonstop abstract interest in the collective noun children, the kind of love Pestalozzi or Froebel had, and you've flushed the priesthood from its lair. Eric Hoffer tells us the prototype true believer is a schoolteacher. Mao was a schoolteacher. So was Mussolini. So were many other prominent warlike leaders of our time, including Lyndon Johnson. In Hoffer's characterization, the true believer is identified by inner fire, a burning conviction we have a holy duty to others. Lack of humor is one touchstone of true belief. The expression true believer is from the 5th century book City of God, occurring in a passage where St. Augustine urges holy men and women to abandon fear and embrace their sacred work fervently. True belief is a psychological frame you'll find useful to explain individuals who relentlessly pursue a cause, indifferent to personal discomfort, indifferent to the discomfort of others. All of us show a tiny element of true belief in our makeup, usually just enough to recognize the lunatic gleam in the eye of some purer zealot when we meet face to face. But in an age which distances us from hand-to-hand encounters with authority, removing us electronically, bureaucratically, and institutionally, the truly fanatical amongst us have been granted the luxury of full anonymity. We have to judge their presence by the fallout. Horace Mann exemplifies the type. From start to finish, he had a mission. He spoke passionately at all times. He wrote notes to himself about, quote, breaking the bond of association among working men, close quote. In a commencement harangue at Antioch College in 1859, he said, be ashamed to die until you have won some victory for humanity, close quote. A few cynical critics snipe at Mann for lying about his imaginary school tour of Prussia, which led to the adoption of Prussian schooling methodologies in America. But those cynics miss the point. For the great ones, the goal is everything. The end justifies any means. Mann lived and died a social crusader. His second wife, Mary Peabody, paid him this posthumous tribute. He was all afire with purpose. Al Shanker, longtime president of the American Federation of Teachers, said in one of his last Sunday advertisements in the New York Times before his death, quote, public schools do not exist to please Johnny's parents. They do not even exist to ensure that Johnny will one day earn a good living at a job he likes, close quote. No other energy but true belief can explain what Shanker might have had in mind. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. A beautiful example of true belief in action crossed my desk recently from the alumni magazine of my own alma mater, Columbia University. Written by the director of Columbia's Institute for Learning Technologies, a bureau at Teachers College, this mailing informed graduates that the education division now regarded itself as bound by a contract with posterity. Something in the tone warned me against dismissing this as customary institutional gas. Seconds later, I learned with some shock that the Teachers College felt obligated to take a commanding role in maintaining the planet. The next extension of this strange idea was even more pointed. Teachers College now interpreted its mandate, I was told, as one compelling itself to distribute itself all over the world and to teach every day 24 hours a day, close quote. To gain perspective, try to imagine the University of Berlin undertaking to distribute itself among the 50 American states, to be present in this foreign land 24 hours a day, swimming in the minds of Mormon children in Utah and Baptist children in Georgia, Any university intending to become global like some nanny creature spawned in Bacon's ghastly utopia New Atlantis is no longer simply in the business of education. Columbia's Teachers College had become an aggressive evangelist by its own announcement, an institution of true belief selling an unfathomable doctrine. I held its declaration in my hand for a while after I read it, thinking. Let me underline what you just heard. Picture some UN thought police dragging reluctant Serbs to a loudspeaker to listen to Teachers College rant. Most of us have no frame of reference in which to fit such a picture. Narcosis, in the face of true belief, is a principal reason the disease progressed so far through the medium of forced schooling, without provoking much major opposition. Only after a million homeschooling families and an equal number of religiously oriented private school families emerged from their sleep to reclaim their children from the government in the 1970s and 1980s, in direct response to an epoch of flagrant social experimentation in government schools, did true belief find ruts in its road. Columbia, where I took an undergraduate degree, is the last agency I would want maintaining my planet. For decades, it was a major New York slumlord, indifferent to maintaining its own neighborhood, a territory much smaller than the globe. Columbia has been a legendary bad neighbor to the community for the 40 years I've lived near my alma mater. So much for its qualifications as planetary guardian. Its second boast is even more ominous. I mean that the goal of intervening in mental life all over the world, teaching every day 24 hours a day. Teaching what? Shouldn't we ask? Our trouble in recognizing true belief is that it wears a reasonable face in modern times. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. Take a case reported by the Public Agenda Foundation, which produced the first ever survey of educational views held by teachers' college professors. To their surprise, the authors discovered that the majority of 900 randomly selected professors of education interviewed did not regard a teacher's struggle to maintain an orderly classroom or to cope with disruptive students as major problems. The education faculty was generally unwilling to attend to these matters seriously in their work, believing that widespread alarm among parents stemming from worry that graduates couldn't spell, couldn't count accurately, couldn't sustain attention, couldn't write grammatically or write at all, was only caused by views of life outmoded and mistaken, close quote. While 92% of the public thinks basic reading, writing, and math competency is, quote, absolutely essential, according to an earlier study by Public Agenda, education professors did not agree. In the matter of mental arithmetic, which a large majority of ordinary people, including some schoolteachers, consider very important, about 60% of education professors think cheap calculators make that goal obsolete. The word passion appears more than once in the report from which these data are drawn, as in the following passage, quote, education professors speak with passionate idealism about their own, sometimes lofty vision of education and the mission of teacher education programs. The passion translates into ambitious and highly evolved expectations for future teachers, expectations that often differ dramatically from those of parents and teachers now in the classroom. The soul of a teacher is what should be passed on from teacher to teacher, a Boston professor said with some intensity. You have to have that soul to be a good teacher. Close quote. It's not my intention at this moment to recruit you to one or another side of this debate, but only to hold you by the back of the neck as Uncle Bud, who you'll meet up ahead, once held mine and point out that this vehicle has no brake pedal. Ordinary parents and students have no way to escape this passion. Twist and turn as they might, they will be subject to any erotic curiosity inspired love arouses. In the harem of true belief, there is scant refuge from the Sultan's lusty gaze. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. In the summer of 1997, a Democratic senator stood on the floor of the Senate denouncing the spread of what he called wacko algebra, one widely distributed math text referred to in that speech. Did not ask a question requiring algebraic knowledge until page 107. What replaced the boredom of symbolic calculation were discussions of the role of Zoos in community life, or excursions to visiting the fascinating Dogon tribe of West Africa. Whatever your own personal attitude toward rainforest algebra, as it was snidely labeled, you would be hard-pressed not to admit one thing. Its problems are almost computation-free. Whether you find the mathematical side of social issues relevant or not isn't in question. Your attention should be fixed on the existence of minds, nominally in charge of number enlightenment for your children, which consider a private agenda more important than numbers. 1 week last spring, the entire math homework in fifth grade at middle class PS 87 on the Upper West Side of Manhattan consisted of two questions. 1. Historians estimate that when Columbus landed on what is now the island of Haiti, there were 250,000 people living there. In 2 years, this number had dropped to 125,000. What fraction of the people who had been living in Haiti when Columbus arrived, remained? Why do you think the Arawaks died? Question 2. In 1515, there were only 50,000 Arawaks left alive. In 1550, there were 500. If the same number of people died each year, approximately how many people would have died each year? In 1550, what percentage of the original population was left alive? How do you feel about this? Tom Lovelace, the professor at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, has no doubt that the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics standards have deliberately de-emphasized math skills, and he knows precisely how it was done. But like other vigorous dissenters who have tried to arrest the elimination of critical intellect in children, he adduces no motive for the awesome project, which has worked so well up to now. Lovelace believes that the real reform project has begun, writing standards that declare the mathematics children will learn. He may be right, but I'm not so sanguine. Elsewhere, there are clues which should check premature optimism. In 1989, according to Lovelace, a group of experts in the field of math education launched a campaign to change the content and teaching of mathematics. This new math created state and district policies which tend to present math reform as religion and identify as sinful behaviors teacher-delivered instruction, individual student desk work, papers corrected for error. Teachers are ordered to keep an elaborate diary on each child's mathematical disposition. Specific skills de-emphasized are learning to use fractions, decimals, percents, integers, addition, subtraction, multiplication, division. All have given way to working with manipulatives like beans and counting sticks, much as the Arawaks themselves would have done, and with calculators. Parents worry themselves sick when fifth graders can't multiply 7 times 5 without hunting for beans and sticks. Students who learn the facts of math deep down in the bone, says Lovelace, gain a sense of number unfathomable to those who don't know them. The question critics should ask has nothing to do with computation or reading ability and everything to do with this. How does a fellow human being come to regard ordinary people's children as experimental animals? What impulse triggers the pornographic urge to deprive kids of volition, to fiddle with their lives? It is vital that you consider this, or you will certainly fall victim to appeals that you look at the worthiness of the outcome sought and ignore the methods. This appeal to pragmatism urges a repudiation of principle, sometimes even on the grounds that modern physics proves there is no objective reality. Whether children are better off or not, being spared the effort of thinking algebraically may well be a question worth debating, but if so, the burden of proof rests on the challenger. Short-circuiting the right to choice is a rapist's tactic or a seducer's. If behind a masquerade of number study, some unseen engineer infiltrates the inner layer of a kid's consciousness, the type of subliminal influence exerted in rainforest algebra, tinkering with the way a child sees the larger world, then in a literal sense the purpose of the operation is to dehumanize the experimental subject by forcing him or her into a predetermined consensus. And I've been reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. We'll continue with more of that chapter next time. Gatto is a former award-winning teacher from New York City, who's now a well-known advocate for self-directed education and homeschooling. John Taylor Gatto has a website, johntaylorgatto.com, where this entire book can be downloaded if you can't wait for next week. This and all prior episodes of Unwelcome Guests can also be downloaded online at unwelcomeguests.org. Thanks to Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio in Seattle for his recording of the talks by David Corton and Antonia Juhasz. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening. To help these poor